Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulippe. Conversations today with composer Paul Drescher and percussionist Stephen Schick about their musical theater collaboration called Schick Machine at Z-Space this weekend. You'll also hear about the Friction Quartet's 5th anniversary concerts at the Center for New Music, and Raisa Simpson, artistic director of the Push Dance Company, shares details about the third season of Push Fest at ODC. Regular contributor Peter Robinson will be by towards the end of the hour talking about the new play at ACT, King Charles III. Also, some other reviews from Peter. Stay with us. Woman performing This Bitter Earth, original music that will be featured as part of the Push Dance Festival at ODC this weekend, in a world premiere by artistic director Raisa Simpson, who joins me in studio. Raisa is founder and artistic director of the San Francisco-based Push Dance Company, who has presented her works in over 50 venues across the United States. She's also a dedicated teacher who has spread her dance wisdom at, among other institutions, UC Davis, Sacramento State, Stanford University, SF State, along with the Alonzo King Lines Dance Center and the San Jose Dance Theater, and many others. Interdisciplinary and collaborative are key words to Raisa's various works, as is their site-specific creation. Among her many honors and awards are the Magritte Mondavi Award, the Margaret Jenkins Chime, the Choreo Project's People's Choice Award, and numerous foundation grants. Raisa, welcome to Open Air.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me on KALW.
Well, you're quite welcome, and we're excited to hear about this weekend's collaborative efforts. 18 choreographers, 2 programs. Tell me how this all got assembled.
So this is our third year producing Push Fest, and it started out 3 years ago with my dance company. We wanted to build a community festival and also bring in 2 artists from outside of California. So this year we have choreographers from Chicago and St. Louis joining us, and the 18 choreographers will be a mixed group of people from around the Bay Area. And I also want to thank Mary Carbonara, who will be performing a solo at the festival, and she's also my publicist.
Oh, very nice. She brought you here, I believe. Great. These artists are active in many different disciplines of dance.
Yes. That's what's so special about the festival, really, is that it's a mixed genre festival. So you will see everything from contemporary dance, which is very popular here in San Francisco, but also you'll see ballet, you'll see classical Indian dance, and an array of different dance groups.
Your work, Mothership, is considered part one. It's one of 3 world premieres. Tell us a little bit about what one would see in Mothership.
Well, I can tell you that it's going to be exciting. What you'll see is the theme of Mothership is sort of this like Afrofuturistic kind of theme. And I'm looking at the past And then I'm sort of, just taking the past and examining the present, what's going on right now. And then this piece is going to give you a glimpse of how I kind of see the future. And, it's my own artistic view of the founding fathers. And the question that I wanted to answer is, what makes America great? Seems to be,
As long as you're not asking what's making America great again.
Right. Exactly. So, I'm going to bring in my own costumes, my own choreography, and I'm working on a music collaboration with Unwoman, and you heard, some of her cello. So we're going to work together on something that I'm composing and that she's composing. It's all going to come together really nicely, I hope.
So this weekend we'll have both recorded and live music.
Yes. In Program B, the Kiva a cappella will be performing for Katarina Wong's piece. And she is one of my dancers and also our resident choreographer. And she is producing a piece called Push Lab. And Push Lab is a workshop that's happening that we're trying to, sort of mix in like an educational component to the festival. So she'll be making a piece. And then two other push dancers, Ashley Gale and Noah James, will co-choreograph a piece.
Very nice. I have to ask you, PUSH is in all caps, PUSH dance, P-U-S-H dance. Is that an acronym then, or is it just for emphasis?
It's for emphasis. There's no acronym. I mean, every now and then I joke around and make up different things when I'm feeling, kind of cheeky about it. But, PUSH is a momentum. It's what sort of, took me in the direction of starting my own dance company. I needed a little push.
There you go. SF Arts curator Heather Delaunier had this to say about PUSH Fest 2016. In this performance, PUSH Dance Company honors two occasions, its 11th home season and third annual PUSH Dance Festival. Some wonderful words of encouragement to attend ODC, pushdance.org. So the performances are the 23rd to the 25th this weekend. Tell me a little bit more about your dancers that are involved.
Well, I have a great group of dancers. I have 8 dancers, and my main dancers are 6. And joining us will be one dancer that I had as a student at UC Davis. And then I also choreographed a piece a while ago on Sacramento State. So he'll be, he's already graduated from Sac State. And so he'll be joining us, 2 apprentices and 2 main members in the piece. And I can tell you that I really love this group. I love my dancers. They're all very special. What makes my work special, are the people that I have in the room with me. And that's what makes each piece very different.
Your works are site-specific. Tell me about something that has been, that you could only do in one place and not another.
Well, I think, the way my process works is that I kind of tailor pieces to locations. So I recently did a piece called Point Shipyard Project at the MOAD downtown, and that piece was just performed last weekend at the Bayview Opera House, their grand reopening. And we took a piece that was done inside a museum and we put it outside in a courtyard of the Opera House. So I like to think that, art can be brung to the people. We can bring art to the people. It's important that communities everywhere get art and understand specifically dance in particular. So I would like to think that, there is no one work that can just be done in one place. We can take dance out of the traditional spaces and bring them to a wider audience.
Very nice. You mentioned some original music that's going to be performed by Unwoman on solo cello. What sort of music are you drawn to? Choreography and dance is so intertwined with music. What are you drawn to that inspires you the most in style of music?
For music, I'm really drawn to the emotionality of music. I really do understand, the technique behind making music happen, and I appreciate that. For Unwoman's music, she considers herself, I believe, a steampunk composer. And she's extremely talented. And, every time we work together, I just say, hey, Unwoman, I need this thing. And I'm very vague about it. And then she sends me something. And I'm like, that's it. And she's, my only composer that can kind of get me, on the first take. We don't have to go back and forth about what we want. It's just, really natural for us to work together.
And is the next season already being planned? Or what happens after this weekend? What are you working on?
Well, after this weekend, you'll see Mothership Part 2. It is a 3-part installment. So Part 2 is primarily looking at diaspora. And this piece is somewhat of a comedy, at least in my mind. I laugh when I see it. But I'll let the audience engage with the dance on the level that they're comfortable with and let it sort of provoke questions that they may have about the piece for themselves.
Raisa Simpson, Artistic Director of Push Dance. More information about their performances of the Push Dance Fest and the other good work you're doing in terms of training dancers is at their website, pushdance.org. Thanks so much for coming in, Raisa.
Thank you, and I appreciate being on a show that's so tailored to the performing arts. It's just really wonderful. So thank you, KALW. Love you guys.
What's our number? 800-525-9917 to call.
Oh, I got quizzed. Okay.
Thanks, Raisa.
Thank you.
The interesting combination of steel drum and string quartet, steel drummers Andy Akiho and his work performed by the Friction Quartet, which is cellist Doug Matches, violist Taya Warblow, and violinists Otis Harriel and Kevin Rogers, who joined me all in studio today. How about a big welcome from everyone? For say hello.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, thank you so much for having us.
Of course. Well, you guys have been really... first of all, I love the name of the quartet, Friction Quartet, because it really just speaks to actually what's happening with a bow on a string. You can actually feel the friction. Is that where the inspiration
for the title
came from? Yeah,
absolutely.
It's
just the physical process of the bow on the string creating sound.
Well, you guys have been really busy. Oh, just over the last 5 years, you've given 70 world premiere performances and commissioned some 32 works for string quartet while also, you know, concentrating on the regular repertoire.
Yeah, that's right.
How have composers come to you, or has it been vice versa? Have you gone to composers?
Oh, it's definitely been both. We've approached some composers like Andy Akiho. He's actually writing a piano quintet for us currently that is supported by a Chamber Music America grant. And he was already extremely successful when we found out about his music, so we definitely had to approach him. But then all the time, composers reach out to us, and we meet local composers at concerts that we go to.
That's cellist Doug Matches of the Friction Quartet. How did you guys first get together?
Well, Doug and I met a long time ago in North Carolina at a summer festival and sort of lost touch, but reconnected again at a summer festival in Italy called Zephyr. And while we were there, Doug and I were playing the Philip Glass String Quartet number 3. And Doug was also in a separate quartet playing Shostakovich 8 with Taya at the time. And one day, Doug just said, Kevin, would you like to start a contemporary string quartet with me? And I said, absolutely. I've been wanting to do that for a very long time. And so I said, if you move to this to San Francisco, we could totally start one. And Doug was like, hey, I really want to come there to study with Jennifer Culp at the conservatory. So he moved to San Francisco, and we started the quartet. And Otis was my very first stand partner at the conservatory, and I just really loved his playing, and Doug also really enjoyed his playing and enjoyed playing with Taya. And we've had some other members. Taya joined us 3 years ago. Otis joined us after our very first concert, so and he feels like a founding member. And yeah, it's been great working with everyone.
Now, can we talk a little bit about the business of building a string quartet? I mean, fresh out of school 5 years ago, trying to form a quartet, getting money, foundation money. What is the business like of creating a string quartet like that?
Well, it's definitely very challenging.
Stump matches?
Yeah. I was fortunate to be in the conservatory doing a professional studies diploma where I had a lot of time to devote to building the quartet, because it's not just about getting together and rehearsing and playing well and finding people you like playing with. I mean, those are all very important things. But you really have to have a clear vision of what you're trying to accomplish and then sort of enact a plan, which, you know, everything from the name of the group to the publicity to your photos to your website. There's just a whole kind of web of different pieces of information that you need to put together, and they all need to work together, all these moving parts.
I'd like to add to that.
This is Kevin Rogers.
One of the most important assets, I think, for our quartet was our ability to build relationships with people we worked with. This definitely is a community kind of thing, playing chamber music and playing concerts. It's not just us playing in one venue over and over again or just one composer. It's collaborating with multiple artists and building those relationships with presenters and other people. It's a very social kind of business, and it's very fortunate to work with so many talented people in the music world.
Well, you're celebrating a fifth-year anniversary with a pair of premier concerts at the Center for New Music on the 29th and 30th next weekend, including world premiere performances of two new commissions by composers Stephen Feigenbaum and Alex Van Gils. Who wants to talk about those new ones there?
I can talk a little bit about it. So Stephen I met several years ago at the Bang on a Can Music Festival. Bang on a Can is sort of in the spotlight right now because Julia Wolf, founding composer of the Bang on a Can Collective, just won a MacArthur Fellowship, which is a huge deal.
Yeah.
So we're really happy for her. She's one of our favorite composers. I became a fan of Stephen's music and asked him to write us a piece, and he was very excited to do that. And then Alex Van Gils is someone I met actually right around when the quartet formed, and we've been talking for many years about collaborating. We started talking about a different project that was kind of much bigger and involved multimedia, and that didn't work out because we didn't get funding. So speaking of the business side,
sure,
of quartets. But fortunately, this worked out that he could write a piece for us. And this piece is about a vision he had while meditating of downtown San Francisco being completely submerged by rising sea level. So kind of an ominous subject. But the music actually sounds quite hopeful to me.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear a little bit from Taya Warbelow, who's just sitting in the background here, letting all the letting all the boys do the talking. So are you helping it to just not just be a boys' club then for the quartet? You're adding a little bit of balance.
Yeah, we actually get the question a lot: what is it like being in a string quartet with three boys? And it used to be a little uncomfortable for me, actually. But these guys are wonderful to work with, and they're very inclusive. And I think maybe having a girl in the group is helpful for them.
Definitely. I wouldn't know how to dress for concerts as well as I do without your help. In addition to your amazing musical talent that you bring to the group.
Otis Ariel wants to chime in here, too.
Yeah, I was just going to say, also, for Taya and I, we come to the group with an interesting perspective because the two of us were not actually very interested in quote-unquote modern, like, contemporary music, especially contemporary classical music. Like, I thought I could just play Haydn and Beethoven and Mozart the rest of my life. And then I joined this group because my desire to play in a quartet was, like, more, like, higher than my desire to play just standard repertoire. So I was like, you know, I'll try it out. And then we ended up playing a piece by John Adams, and I just totally fell in love with the concept of not understanding a piece the first time you hear it. And it was just like a revolutionary moment for me. And
nice.
I think Ty also went through something similar. So
I think we've both become converts to new music. And one of the things that I realized after I joined the quartet, because I grew up in a place where you don't really hear a lot of new classical music. And so I did play just the standards like Otis. And I realized, I don't know why it took me so long, but all those standards that we love and hear all the time, they were new music. They were the weird stuff
at
one point.
That's a good point.
And if you're participating in it now, either as a composer or a performer or even an audience member going and supporting the artist that you love, you get to create the classics of the future, which is a really special thing to be able to do in a life.
That's very nice. I'm wondering, though, there's got to be a time where you've encountered a piece that you might have stepped in over your heads, or you've said, you know, this just doesn't work. How do you handle that with the composer?
Well, I was going to say,
here's Otis again.
Yeah, we step in over our heads like all the time because composers are writing more and more difficult things. But it's a great thing, actually, because you step into this piece and you're like, wow, I don't understand it, or even I don't like it. And you realize that actually throughout history there have been many, many pieces which people have not liked. One really famous example that we've been playing a lot recently is Ravel's string quartet, who even the dedicated person at Ferré did not like the piece.
Oh, yeah. I mean, from the Tchaikovsky piano concerto or violin concerto as well. Unplayable. You know, yeah.
So
play that.
So we try not to approach things by saying, oh, like, this is too hard. You know, this is obviously not going to work out. We try our best to make it work. And sometimes we're even surprised that maybe a piece that we collectively are like, I'm not so sure about it. An audience member afterwards will be like, that was the piece that really hit me. And you're like, yeah, that's why I play this music.
That's Otis Harial, part of the Friction Quartet, which also includes Kevin Rogers on violin, Taya Warbelow on viola, and Doug Matches on cello. They're celebrating 5 years of a collective, and the concerts will be next Thursday and Friday at the Center for New Music, which is at the base of Taylor Street. Thursday's program will include works including Friction by Roger Briggs, work by Lauren Loicano, Stephen Feigenbaum, who was just mentioned, as well as Philip Glass's String Quartet No. 3. Friday's concert, works by Isaac Shankler, Ursula Kwong Brown, Alex Van Gils, and Pierce Helliwell. All names that we need to get to know, apparently.
Yeah, I just want to add one thing. These concerts are also celebrating the end of our year as ensemble in residence at the Center for New Music. So they're an incredible organization that gave us the opportunity to have a space to work for the entire year, and also a monetary award and concert opportunities. And they're just an incredible part of the community, and I encourage everyone to check out their website. They have concerts almost every day.
At centerfornewmusic.org, and more information about the Friction Quartet at their website, frictionquartet.com. Guys, you had, guys and gal, I'm sorry, collective, Friction, you had one other excerpt you wanted to share with us. What's the name of the piece?
It's titled Satellites by Garth Knox.
Garth Knox, Satellites. Thanks for coming in, and I wish you some wonderful performances next weekend.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Excerpt from Satellites by Garth Knox. It was a work commissioned by the Kronos Quartet, good friends of KALW, as part of their 50 for the Future project. And that was a performance by the Friction Quartet, celebrating 5 years of performances with a pair of concerts next Friday, Thursday and Friday, at the Center for New Music, centerfornewmusic.org. and frictionquartet.com for more information about them. Good afternoon, David Latulippe here. Listening to Open Air, still to come this hour, a conversation with Peter Robinson, who just caught King Charles III at ACT, and a segment next with a regular guest and good friend of the station, Paul Drescher. But first, I'd like to talk with Matt Martin for a moment about public radio in general and Open Air today.
And specifically, I want to talk about what it means at KALW for us to have a connection to the creative community. And it's a very direct and human connection in that we're really fortunate to have some of the great creators and activists and artists and thinkers of the Bay Area walk in here and give of themselves through these microphones on a daily basis. And it's one of the real pleasures that I have in my work, and I'm sure, David, you feel the same way, that we get to welcome these folks into our studios and amplify their voices across the community. And Paul Drescher is one of those folks who we've brought into our studios many times, and I think that there's been a real bond formed. And I know, Paul, you have been a great supporter of the station, so I just want to give you an opportunity to say a little something about your connection to the station and why you think it's worth supporting.
Well, it is a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Matt and David, for having us in. And I'm often here on Sarah Cahill's program as well.
Sure.
And I was often on Alan Farley's programs when Alan was here in years past. Yeah. I've been listening to the station for much longer than I've been coming into the station, and I've been a subscriber for at least two decades, I would say. And it's a real pleasure. I listen to it, obviously, when I have my morning coffee, I'm listening to the station, and obviously it's a great deal of public affairs broadcast during the daytime. I listen to the music programs in the evening, and they're incredibly varied, from Africa Mix to the different programs, the folk music programs, and it's just a wonderful opportunity to hear a range of things, both of things that are going on in the Bay Area, artistically, in terms of important political issues that are happening both locally and nationally. It is the place that I come to get my information and my entertainment.
800-525-9917. This is one of two times a year that we come to you and ask you to show that sort of support for the variety of programming we have. It's Paul Drescher here with Matt Martin. Matt, we've had a tremendous day so far, and we just need to keep it moving if we're going to end this today.
That's right. Our aim is to end this campaign on time and at our goal. We're just under $86,000 to go, thanks to everyone who's given over the past 10 days and who's done that today. And we ask you to join them at 800-525-9917, 800-525-9917. If you appreciate a station that has this direct connection with the creators of the Bay Area, it is your support that makes that possible. And it's very different. This is not what public radio sounds like everywhere. This is what public radio sounds like here because of the commitment of listeners. Thank you, Paul, for your support. And thank you when you call or give your contribution at kalw.org.
Thanks, Matt. We'll talk to you a little later in the hour. And Paul, thank you again for you've stepped up on many an occasion in terms of offering some extra challenge dollars, which you did part of yesterday morning's.
Well, it's a pleasure to support the station. And in this case, we have something that we're actually hoping to get the word out on.
Indeed. This is an amazing creation that's been going, that you've been working on. That's this weekend at Z Space on Florida Street. It's called The Schick Machine. Now, it's not just a concert. This is sort of a performance piece in many ways. And first of all, we should also introduce Stephen Schick.
Yes, so here in the studio with me is Stephen Schick, my collaborator, and also very well known to the Bay Area as the artistic director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players. And I've known Steve for a number of years, and I think it was in 2005 that Steve had seen a video of an earlier invented instrument work called Soundstage, And he said, could you make me a piece, a solo piece, where there was no traditional instrument on stage? And I was intrigued. I'd known Steve as a percussionist in the Bang on a Can All-Stars. I'd seen him perform in that group a number of times. But I was still a little – he had to convince me that he was up for the kind of collaborative process and experimentation. I suspect that he would, but he basically showed me some videos of things he'd done with a wonderful director in France, and also performances that he'd done of a classic work called Ursonata. And I said, okay, he can do this. And then I introduced my longtime collaborator Rindy Eckert to Steve, and it was clear that we had a team that could make a work that isn't just by any means to be something that you here, you have to see it. And in fact, we'll be at a little bit of a deficit here today. If we play audio excerpts, it's a little bit not, it's just half of what any part of the work is about.
Well, welcome to you, Stephen Schick, who I should also mention is the artistic director of the San Francisco Contemporary Music Players and music director of the La Jolla Symphony.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks so much.
Boy, so you are the main event, though. You are the man behind the machine.
Yeah, I don't know if that makes me the main event. That makes me the sole living performer on stage. But there are so many events in this piece, from movable robots that spin and make sounds to instruments that are extraordinary in terms of their breadth and their sonic diversity, to little teeny things where you think, well, that can't make a sound, and it turns out to make a fascinating one. And so there are so many things. And in fact, Paul was talking about the process by which the piece began. And at some point, shortly after our phone call in 2005, I found myself in his studio in Oakland, which was a big open space covered with interesting-looking junk. 4 years later, after having experimented and improvised and composed and everything like that, Paul's space was covered with interesting-looking junk that made interesting sounds. And so it was. I think it took us 4 years to rearrange the contents of your studio, and that has become the set and the sounding surfaces of Schick Machine.
Well, this is also going on the road, I understand. This isn't just the Z-Space isn't the only spot it's going
to
be.
Right. We're taking it to Maryland. It'll be there in October. So after we leave here, we put it in a container.
I was going to say, how many semis are
It will fit in a – well, it will go in a 53-foot container that will go first on a truck and then on a rail. But we actually got it to the studio in a 26-foot truck, so it can be trucked in a more normal fashion.
Well, let's hear a little bit more from this piece. Well, not a little bit more. Let's hear a little bit from this piece. We're going to hear first an excerpt from Perk Table. What's that, a percussion table?
Okay, so basically, the percussion table is that it's just – it's a table we built, and we populated that table with a lot of junk, a little thing, little objects. Some of them we made, some of them we broke, some of them we modulated something that might have been an object that might have been a sounding object or might not have been. There's some things that are like pots and pans. There's maybe a bell. There's a broken cymbal. There's a lot of sort of woodblock objects that I was fascinated with, and it's just basically an arrangement of what looks like more or less junk that Steve, with his extraordinary musicality and technique, can turn into music. Now, in addition to that, there is also a device that we call the flapper, and this is an important contribution by our other key collaborator, Matt Heckert, who may be known to some people in the Bay Area as one of the members at one point of Survival Research Laboratories, which produced these astonishing performances with machines and robots and sound and fireworks or explosions and remote-controlled, you know, mayhem. And Matt, I really wanted to work with machines in this piece, and partly because for a solo performer, I knew that it would be important to be able to build up a very large amount of sound, and we can do that if we have machines under computer control. So that's part of the reason. But Matt's ideas and aesthetics were really interesting to me, and so Matt built this little device for the percussion table called a flapper, and it's just basically three pieces of metal, three metal bands that are clamped at the bottom and loose at the top, and it oscillates back and forth, and Steve can control the speed of it, and it becomes kind of a metronome for his performance. So you'll hear this repeated metronomic thing along with Steve's much more elaborate improvisation.
An excerpt from Schick Machine and then more with Stephen Schick and Paul Drescher. excerpt from Schick Machine, performed by virtuoso percussionist Stephen Schick, a collaborative project with Paul Drescher, Rindy Eckert, visual design of Tom Ontiveros, instrument inventor, educator Daniel Schmidt, as well as sound artist Matt Heckert. Paul Drescher and Stephen Schick joining me in studio. The visuals on here must be really something to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's particularly as we get it, if we play other examples, this is in some ways one of the more conventional. You strike an object like you would a percussion instrument, and it makes a sound.
I think what's important to say is that the entire performance is framed in a theatrical way, so that it's not just the performance of these instruments. There are words that Rindy has written and a theatrical concept about a guy by the name of Laszlo Klangfarben, who seeks to understand his ever more complicated life through the construction of musical instruments. And in fact, it seems to me very much what musicians do in any event, to take a look at the world and see it through, or rather hear it through, the lens of the music that they make. But in this particular instance, the character that I play is surrounded by his own, in quotation marks, musical inventions. And it's through these inventions that the world makes sense. He longs to leave this place, but he can't afford to distance himself from the machine that he has built by which the world gathers its sense.
It's in making the work, the thing that was an interesting tension that I think we actually succeeded at this is that when you're making a large-scale work, if you're writing an orchestra piece, if you're writing a dramatic work or an opera, whatever, you have to always be aware of the very large form that you're creating and that it has to make sense, and all the individual ingredients and pieces have to add up to something that is greater than the sum of the parts at the end of the work. And so we're very much aware of that while building this project. At the same time, we were constantly being seduced by the in-the-moment pleasure of just what this instrument, this object, could create. And that tension is really the tension that's of Laszlo's life. It's between this grand concept of a machine that somehow will make sense of the past, present, and the future. And then he's constantly being seduced into the moment of his interaction with his creations.
And it's not just the tension of Laszlo's life. It's the tension of Steve's life, too. Because, you know, I have in my studio at the University of California in San Diego, where I teach, and when I'm up here with the contemporary music players, a lot of conventional percussion instruments. I practice those every day. But my original commission to Paul, or original proposal to Paul, was to make a piece for no pre-existing instruments. So we invented everything.
Well, he's just the guy for that.
He is exactly the guy. And the problem that I never foresaw at that moment was how would I practice these things? I don't have these at home. And so the very thing that's remarkable and attractive is the thing that means that I show up at a theater with 48 hours before a performance and then have to relearn all of these instruments, not the least of which is about a 12-foot-long hurdy-gurdy that Paul calls the hurdy-grande, which is a very particular performance technique that, frankly, I would love to be able to practice. But something interesting always comes out of it.
Percussionist Stephen Schick with Paul Drescher Ensemble. Opening night reception tomorrow at 8 at Z-Space. The Schick Machine is the performance. Fascinating work. We're going to hear the hurdy-grande in just a minute. But, Paul, I need to say that, of course, you are just the guy to bring these instruments to life, having brought to life back in 2012 the concerto for quadricord that you created and for a commission for the Berklee Symphony.
That was a very big project. That was the first time that I did such an elaborate blending of one of my invented instruments with a symphony orchestra, or with a large ensemble and a full-scale work. That was a 30-minute, three-movement symphonic work.
And a conversation for another time in a couple weeks will
be... And Steve actually did that with the La Jolla Symphony
as
well.
Yeah, I conducted the piece with Paul as a soloist.
Oh,
yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. Nice, nice. And we'll talk another time on Open Air about your upcoming collaboration with the Berklee Symphony, Crazy Eights, and Fractured Symmetries, which will be...
That's the new work that premieres on October 13th.
October 13th, so we'll have you on for another time about that. So how did the concept of the hurdy-grande come about?
Well, so when one decides to invent an instrument, or when one has that inclination to build one's own instrument, you can come at it from a variety of different directions. One is you can just experiment with materials and to see what is possible with materials based on your prior experience and knowledge of how to handle materials. The other is if you see a phenomena that exists in the musical world and you think, well, that could be explored more deeply or in a different way or on a different scale. And scale is one of the things that I've started to explore when I started to work in music theater with invented instruments. And in fact, the quadrichord is an instrument that came very much out of that question of, I'm a string player, I'm a guitar player, and I play piano, and I know how strings behave. And I also know that when you make things bigger, they behave differently. And so I said, well, let's quadruple the length of a string. What would be on a guitar string would be between 2 and 3 feet long. On the quadrichord, the strings are about 15 feet long. And so the music becomes very different musical possibilities happen and very different sounds happen. So I asked the same question. I became fascinated with the hurdy-gurdy, the traditional European folk instrument that's been around and manifest in really all over Europe and Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and still exists as a kind of a quixotic sort of quirky instrument. You see it in paintings by Hieronymus Bosch. You see giant hurdy-gurdies there, in fact, and you see it in folk revels by Bruegel's paintings like that. So it was a very important folk instrument in the medieval times, and its salient feature is it has a bow. I mean, it has strings that are bowed by a wooden wheel that is cranked by hand, and it also has mechanical frets. So you press fingers into a keyboard. I was not interested in the fretting part, but I was very interested in the mechanical bowing. And so I started to experiment with that and made it much bigger, made the strings much longer, and put a motor on the, so I didn't have a hand crank. I wanted my hands free to play, both hands free to play, so I didn't have to hand crank. I put it on a motor and started to experiment and discovered some completely new ways to make sound and to activate strings that can't be done on any traditional instrument. And I think you will hear in this the version that we do in this piece is what we call the prototype of the instrument. I was so fascinated by what we made for this piece and what Steve discovered in it that we went and built a very more refined version of it. But we've always kept the original very funky looking instrument as part of Schick Machine, because in fact Schick Machine is about that process of discovery. It's not about the polished, finished, perfect thing. It's about the process of creative discovery.
We'll hear the Hurdy Grande as we go out, but not before reminding people that the performances are Friday, opening night reception at 8, Saturday at 3 and 8, and then Sunday at 3 p.m. at Z-Space. Z-Space is at 470 Florida Street. The project is the Paul Drescher Ensemble presents Schick Machine with percussionist Stephen Schick. And also, after every performance, you're going to be invited on stage to explore the instrument itself.
Yes, right? That's the second half of the program, is inviting the entire audience on stage to do their own sort of experimentation and exploration of the instruments. And in fact, the 470 is Z below, and in fact, the Z space, the primary space where we are upstairs, is 450 Florida Street, although they are literally next door to each other or on top of one another.
Full information at zspace.org. Paul Drescher, Stephen Schick, thanks for coming in.
It's a pleasure.
It was my pleasure as well. Thank you.
Here is the Hurdy Grande, an invention of Paul Drescher as part of the Schick Machine. Excerpt from The Chic Machine, The Hurdy Grandy, created by Paul Drescher and being performed by Stephen Chic, part of The Chic Machine at Z Space, the main Z Space, 440 Florida Street, around there, zspace.org for more information. An appropriate introduction to our next segment with contributor Peter Robinson, who I actually saw at a performance and sat right next to the man for King Charles III, which is currently at ACT. A rather different telling of the royal family story, wouldn't you say, Peter?
Yes, I would. Now, don't forget, I'm just sitting down because normally you rise and stand to attention for God Save the Queen.
Not if you're Colin Kaepernick. No. what would he do? What would Colin do?
He would genuflect and then hope to be knighted. Well, anyhow, the play, Charles III, written by Mike Bartlett and directed by David Muse, is now playing at ACT. And I think it is a wonderful fictional consideration of what would happen if you had a constitutional crisis in Great Britain and you had to ask the question, should the king, that would be Prince Charles in this case, resign, or as we would say, abdicated, and would indeed Prince William take over, and how would that come about? So these are real serious questions, but it's a satirical take, and I think it really brings like four issues to the forefront. The first is family relations, father and son, father and daughter-in-law. It brings the question of the two houses of Parliament, the House of Lords and the House of Commons, how they relate constitutionally to the Crown. And then it looks at the bigger picture, the relationship of the Crown to the people. And then finally, just for good measure, it throws in the press. Should they have freedom of expression or should they be gagged? So these are all big, big subjects, but in course it's on theatre, it's on stage, and it is presented highly dramatically.
Indeed, almost Shakespearean at times, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. In fact, what you get used to are the iambic pentameters, because it is written in blank verse, and you get a kind of rhythm to the speaking voices. And I think Jean Paulson does a good job as Camilla. The Prince William is played by Christopher McClendon. And as the play progresses, you become more and more involved in the intricacies of the family relationships. Prince Harry is, of course, Harry Smith. That's his real name in real life. And Kate is played by Alison Jean White. And these are all real characters, and you have a sense of feeling for them. So if you're enjoying a good night at the theatre, this is certainly a combination of humour and tragedy to some extent. It combines history with politics, comedy with pathos, and on some of the bigger issues, the whole constitutional crisis, and I think above all, the hint of Shakespeare in the background, rhythm, music, wit, and feeling.
Indeed, at act-sf.org. These are all characters that we're familiar with from the headlines of the world and from the gossip pages. It's fascinating to see these characters in this kind of a fictional situation. It's really well done.
It's well done, and I think just a tip, if you're not familiar with the way the Queen's English is pronounced or spoken, pick up a set of headsets on the right as you go into the theatre, and they will bring it clearly to your ears. And one line they never use, but I always enjoy it from Shakespeare, uneasy rests the head that wears the crown.
Well, from the world of theatre and Britain, British theatre, so to speak, we go to the world of film. She loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah. what could be more British than the Beatles?
Indeed, the British invasion and running at the Kabuki is a movie with two titles. One is simply The Beatles, and the other is The Touring Years, the years that they went on tour. And it's directed by Ron Howard, and I will make an age admission. I am the same age as Paul McCartney, so I actually grew up in Liverpool, and some of the scenes in the cavern, which is where they first began, really brought a sense of nostalgia to me. In fact, when I first heard them, they were a second act in a Jamaican steel band where they get on number. So this is a story about the four lads from Liverpool. It's about how Brian Epstein, their manager, brought them together, kept them together, and eventually they go on a world tour, which in this country opened up with an appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. And we get into something which became called Beatlemania. And we also see them in other places. They played in Japan, they played in Australia, they played, of course, in Hamburg on one of the more famous tours. And you see the development of music from both a musician's point of view and also from a pop music cultural point of view. And as the film, which is documentary, is partly black and white, it moves into the phase where they change to Indian music. The sitar becomes part of their growth. Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts is, of course, the embit of this period, because we're looking from roughly 1962 to 1966. So if you're a Beatles fan, if you want to hear some great tunes, if you want to see how music developed, and above all, if you want that cheeky Liverpudlian sense of humour, never taking life too seriously, but at the same time having something seriously to say, then The Beatles is a movie well worth seeing.
Thank you, Peter. Another film that you're seeing, worth seeing, I understand, is the drama that took place on the Hudson River a while back.
That's right. It's called Sully. And I've got to say, in this, Tom Hanks plays the pilot. He does a totally wonderful job. And one of the things I like, they don't refer to passengers on the plane. They call them souls. I have 100 souls or 200 souls in my hands. Now, I think this is really two films. One is the film of the miracle on the Hudson, the actual landing of the plane, and the second half is the investigation, how they actually begin to investigate, did Sully make the right decision not to turn back and head to LaGuardia, or did he in fact do what he decided to do, which was a sheer act of complete experience and craftsmanship, bringing this huge jet down on the Hudson River. Now, I know, David, you're flying on Virgin Atlanta, and I'm, too, flying in a couple of weeks to the UK. So I, too, want to be referred to as a soul. I don't want to be a passenger. I want extra legroom, and I'm looking for a pilot who reminds me of Sully as we trip across the pond.
Thank you, as always, Peter. We'll see you next time. Appropriate to have some Beatles music as we talked about the Beatles movie in the background with a little help from my friends. David Latulip, joined once again by Matt Martin here in studio, asking for your support for local public radio.
800-525-9917. That's the number that we are asking you to call to show your support for local public radio, aiming to wrap up this campaign as a success. We have had so much support today, and we hope that you will join people like Dorothy Burson in Oakland, who gave her support to local public radio. Also, Sunny Sarkis in San Francisco, Danielle O'Hare, also here in the city, Lisa Nelbach in Emeryville, all going to KALW.org just in this hour. We thank you so much for getting involved.
800-525-9917 is the number to call. Just wanting to thank my producer, Niels Swinkels, for this week's show. Looking forward to next week as well. I'll have a guest host here, still to be determined. Thanks, Niels. And our shows are archived at KALW.org, so you can catch any of the shows there. And it's there you can make a donation to local public radio, showing your support not only for the arts coverage, but for the local and international aspect of programming here, as we're about to go to London for the BBC News, which we carried first here in the Bay Area.
That's right. And many listeners tell us what they appreciate about KALW is that there is a diversity of programming. That means voices and perspective, ideas and music. And, every single thing on the station may not be for you. There are a few people who do listen all the time. And if you're one of them, I have a feeling you're probably a member already. And we thank you for your support. But if there is something here in this mix that you think is valuable, or you think it's great to have local performing artists followed by news from London, and you like that combination, your support keeps it strong. Make a call now at 800-525-9917. 800-525-9917 or KALW.org.
800-525-9917 is the number to call on this, our final day of our fall membership campaign. We're not going to come back to you until May of 2017, and we're going to get by with a little help from our friends by making that call, 800-525-9917. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, David.
800-525-9917, online at KALW.org. Our fall membership campaign winding up and having a tremendous response today here at KALW in our temporary studios. We hope to be in our permanent space, revived at here at Burton High School come December or so. But we're going to need your support to help keep things going in the meantime. 800-525-9917. This is KALW San Francisco. We go to London now for the BBC NewsHour, recorded earlier for broadcast at this time.